Tonight, this afternoon, I'd like to explore some from the perspective of the wisdom teachings the Buddha offered. Some of these teachings are not necessarily obvious. They are subtle, profound, and hard to understand at times. It's said that the night of the Buddha's awakening, or the days following the Buddha's awakening, it occurred to him to teach and to try to explore with people what he had learned, to share his understanding. But the thought crossed his mind, something along the lines of, this Dharma that I have understood is very subtle, hard to see. If I were to try to explain it to people, they wouldn't understand it, and that would be vexing. So the story goes on that a celestial being, a Deva, appeared to him and said, please, please teach your teachings. Some people will understand your teachings. So the teachings, the wisdom that is offered or shared with us is not always so obvious. It requires us to radically shift our perspective on things that seem quite obvious or clear to us, the way to approach them. So the piece I'd like to explore today is transforming our understanding or relationship to suffering. Our usual perspective on suffering, I think, for many of us, at least before we meet the teachings, is something like, if there's suffering, then there's something wrong. It's a problem. It needs to be fixed. It needs to be changed. And if I can't figure out how to do that, there's something wrong with me. So we kind of veer between having an aversion to the suffering and feeling like needing to control it or fix it, and almost just giving up, you know, feeling like if we can't do that, then we're helpless. And this question about suffering, the Buddha looked out at the world from the time that he was a young man and said, What is happening here in the world? Why do beings suffer? And that was his question. That was his search. That exploration of that question was his whole motivation. Is it possible to be free from suffering? One of the key pieces that he brought to this investigation or this quest, this search, was first, almost with a kind of a scientific kind of mind, he decided, I think I said this the other day, he decided, what I need to do is to understand what suffering is, and then maybe I'll understand how it might be possible to be free. With a scientist's mind, if there is a cause of suffering, if I can understand that, perhaps there's a possibility of letting go of that cause. And so this is the first hint for us of a different perspective. Rather than having an immediate reaction of either, you know, aversion, thinking there's a problem around our suffering, something needs to, you know, we need to get rid of it, or in the event of feeling like it's not possible, feeling helpless, that we can go right between these two and understand the experience. What is this suffering? What is this experience that I am calling suffering? So that's a key bit of wisdom that the Buddha offers to understand our suffering. In the texts, the term dukkha, which is the term usually translated as suffering, is used in different ways. And I'd like to just review that because it actually elucidates some perhaps misunderstandings or also I think helps to clarify some things about this word, dukkha. One of the ways that this word dukkha is used is to mean unpleasantness. It's used in the context of all experience having a feeling tone of being either pleasant, unpleasant, or neither pleasant nor unpleasant. So in that context, the term dukkha is used. When unpleasant experience arises, it is called dukkha vedana, dukkha feeling. A second way that this word is used is to mean, it's sometimes talked about as being a characteristic of experience, that experience is inherently dukkha. And a translation for the word in that context, perhaps not suffering so much as a translation for the word in that context, but unreliable. That every experience that we have, there's nothing in our mind-body set of mind-body processes, all experience that we have is impermanent. It will change, doesn't last very long. And because of that, it is not a place or an experience. There is no experience we can possibly have that will be reliable as a source of lasting happiness. I think this is one of the key insights the Buddha had, is that there's nothing in experience itself that is going to do it in terms of finding happiness. Happiness will not be found in constructing or holding on to or having any particular experience, because the very moment that it's here, it's already dissolving, it's already falling apart. And so everything in our experience is inherently unreliable in this way in terms of finding happiness, finding a lasting, true happiness. And this is what the Buddha was looking for. He was looking for a reliable, a place of reliable happiness. And he realized it's not found in experience, not found in having experience. Inherently, the changing nature of experience means it's unreliable. So this is the second way that the word dukkha is used. From this standpoint, everything is dukkha. Everything is unreliable. These first two kinds of dukkha, the unpleasant sensation, often we could call it pain in the body, for example, and this unreliable characteristic of experience, these are facts of life. And this is something else I think the Buddha realized. These don't go away. The unreliability of experience is not going to change. The one thing that doesn't change. So these two kinds of dukkha don't come to an end. Being in a human body, we will experience both of these. The Buddha continued to experience the changing flow of experience, and he also continued to experience physical pain following his awakening. So the third kind of dukkha that the Buddha talked about, or that's referred to in the text, is the dukkha of the First Noble Truth, which, as I understand it, is essentially a result of our relationship largely to these first two kinds of dukkha, particularly the characteristic of dukkha. So the dukkha of the First Noble Truth is the experience of suffering, the experience of other words for it, stress, dissatisfaction, unease, discomfort, struggle, many different words that get at this feeling that something is off. It can be that subtle. The word suffering evokes often a stronger feeling in us. We think of the large sufferings. But the word dukkha, actually the Pali word dukkha, the du part means bad. And I've heard different understandings of the second part, and I'll just pick one today. The second part, the ka part, the Pali English dictionary says it's space. Ka means space. So, bad space. Dukkha, bad space. It can be the subtlest of off, you know, just things just don't feel right. And it can be the greatest of struggles, of misery, of despair. This is the kind of dukkha that the Buddha said he found an end to. This kind of dukkha, he pointed to our reactivity to experience, our relationship to experience being the key. That we basically, most of our dukkha, this experience of dukkha arises because we want things to be other than they are. Essentially, we want things to be permanent when we like them, and we want them to go away when we don't like them. So the dukkha of the First Noble Truth is a reaction in our minds. It is created by a relationship with experience. Stuff happens. Stuff happens in the world. Things will impinge on our bodies and create painful experience. Loss happens. Impermanence happens. And at a very deep level in our minds rebel against this. It's like, no, there has got to be somewhere that happiness can be found. There has got to be some place in this stream that I can just hold it still for a while and be happy. So that not being in alignment with the truth of unreliability, essentially, is the largest reason why we suffer. One of the ways the Buddha described the experience of freedom is when someone is freed from greed, aversion, and delusion, they experience no mental pain or grief. So that mental reactivity to experience is not there. The result of no mental pain and grief is a very deep peace. But it comes not from having peace, not from holding on, but from letting go. An endless, endless letting go. So the the teaching the Buddha offered here is that understanding how we feel this dukkha, understanding this, this is a pathway for us. And this is the first noble truth. The Buddha suggested the action associated with the first noble truth, understand dukkha. This understanding is not about an intellectual understanding. In my experience with the teachings and with where the benefit has come from the teachings, it's not about thinking about it. Not about thinking about our suffering and trying to figure out why did this happen and what can I do differently. But rather the understanding is about being with the experience of suffering. Opening to, this is what it's like for anger to be happening. This is what it's like for confusion to be happening. This is what it's like for frustration to be happening. This is what it's like for pride to be happening. So this understanding, getting to know our dukkha, the ways that we feel struggle, is really a key for us. There's a text, it's one of my favorite texts, and I really began to explore it about a year ago. We offered it to the teacher trainees in the Spirit Rock Teacher Training Program. We were teaching about this text, and I just dove into this. It's like, wow, this text provides a whole path for us. It's called The Simile of the Cloth. And it begins with an analogy. The Buddha is talking to his disciples, his followers, and says, if there were a cloth that had all kinds of stains on it, and you dyed that cloth, you immersed it into a vat of dye, would that cloth look beautiful? And no, because the stains make the cloth darker in those areas, that the dye isn't taken up evenly through the cloth with the stains. And he said, he made an analogy to our minds, that when our minds have stains, often this is this term stain is kilesa. It's often translated as defilement. But I like the fact that it's this word for staining cloth. It's the same word, kilesa. They use it in that way as well. So it's like, I like this analogy because the stains come from outside of the cloth. They're not inherent in the cloth. And often we can clean the cloth. We can use soap and engage in an activity that takes the stains out of the cloth before dipping it into the dye. So the Buddha makes an analogy around our minds, that our minds need to be cleansed of stain, and then with that purity, the practice unfolds. With the purity of mind, essentially, the mind takes up the practice very naturally, organically. I think of this analogy being the dye, like dipping into the dye of the Dharma. That when those stains are, that the defilements or stains of mind are abandoned, the mind takes up the Dharma. So the Buddha goes through a number of defilements and says, you know, here's a whole list. He gives a laundry list of defilements, and I won't read them out, but it basically covers a variety of states of mind that are around greed, aversion, and delusion. He mentions things like ill will, anger, resentment, conceit, vanity, negligence, fraud, deceit, a whole laundry list of things, envy, covetousness, things like that. And then he says, knowing that these are stains, defilements in the mind, one abandons them. Now this, I think, takes some exploration. You know, what does it mean to abandon something? The word abandon, sometimes we have a negative connotation to it, you know, that we think of abandoning a child. We abandon something that we should be taking care of. But there's another term, use of the term, and that's like, you know, we abandon something when it's no longer useful to us. You know, a car that breaks down, we would abandon it. So the this is more my understanding of the use of the word abandon here, that abandoning happens when we understand that something is no longer useful. And how do we understand that these defilements, these stains of the mind, these variations of greed, aversion, and delusion, how do we understand that they aren't useful? We know them. We explore them. Be with them. It's that turning back to what is it like for ill will to be arising? What is it like for anger to be arising? This is largely the way to abandoning. Understanding the defilements in this way leads to abandoning. So the abandoning here, my understanding of this and what I've seen, when there is a deep abandoning, the way it happens is because wisdom understands at a very deep level, this isn't useful anymore. This is not useful, and the mind lets go of it. That's the deeper kind of abandoning. So, abandoning is the fruit of understanding, the fruit of wisdom, essentially. And wisdom comes through the willingness to engage, to meet our difficulties. So the text continues. I won't go in as much detail as I did in just that little section, because I want to talk a little bit about actually meeting our difficulties here, you know, some tools, some ways to do that. But the text goes on, and it's very inspiring. It's a very inspirational text, because he goes on to say that once these defilements have been abandoned, one acquires unwavering confidence in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. So unwavering faith arises with the letting go of the defilements. We see, actually, the letting go of defilements like this, it creates a state of mind called the bliss of seclusion. You know, the mind is no longer battered about by these states of mind. Very, very peaceful experience. And so the abandoning of these defilements through understanding leads to confidence in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And then he goes on to say, with confidence in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, inspiration arises, gladness arises, rapture arises, tranquility arises, and concentration arises. So out of the faith in that unwavering faith that arises with the abandoning of the defilements, the path of developing concentration, tranquility, beauty of mind naturally follows. He doesn't say that you have to work. He says, one possessed of unwavering confidence in the Buddha gains inspiration in the Dhamma, gains gladness connected to the Dhamma. When one is glad, rapture is born. One who's rapturous, the body becomes tranquil. One whose body becomes tranquil feels pleasure. One who feels pleasure, the mind becomes concentrated. A natural unfolding, like taking up the dye. A natural unfolding. From there, it's said that the mind of awareness and metta naturally arise. And then there's still a step to do. The final step there is to turn and understand that even these beautiful states of mind are impermanent. And that is said to lead to the full freedom, complete freedom, no mental pain or grief. And so our primary work of the practice is this understanding of struggle, of difficulty. That's where we engage. And then in that engagement, we see in many different ways, as we engage with that, we get little tastes of the freedom of letting go around a particular defilement. And we see just hints of this path unfolding in our minds. We see how with the release, I remember on one retreat, there was a releasing of self-hatred through understanding. You know, the mind understood in a moment. It had been watching self-hatred for quite a while, and in a moment, the mind understood this self-hatred is simply the arising of a thought in the mind. It is constructed. It is ephemeral. It's nothing. The mind understood that in a split second. And the mind went in a split second from self-hatred to bliss. That wisdom freeing the mind and leading to the bliss. So we get tastes of that as we practice. I certainly did not live for the rest of my life in bliss. And in fact, in the very next moment, the mind recognized that bliss too, that's impermanent. And then there's a little bit more balance, you know. So we just get little tastes as we practice through meeting these struggles, through meeting the defilements. So exploring difficulty is our path. It is not a mistake. It is not a problem. It actually is our path when struggle is arising. To learn to engage with it, to meet it, to be with it. That's the basic instruction. The basic instruction around struggle is recognizing how is it to feel the struggle? What is it like to have struggle arising in this moment? That's the basic instruction. I like the phrase be with for myself. That's a phrase that allows my mind to kind of settle and relax around an experience. And it can, of course, be difficult at times to simply be with experience. This is, I think, a lot of the the ways we've learned particular tools. You know, when we see our minds reacting about something, you know, so we see, oh, there's anger in our minds, but we've got all of these other things piled on top of the anger, all kinds of other attitudes, relationships, even to that anger of like, this is a problem, this is means I'm a bad person that I have this anger. So when we have a lot of other things piled on top of an experience, sometimes overwhelm happens, and we need to use other tools. We need to open our eyes. We need to go out into nature. We need to do other things. And that we have a whole bunch of tools in our toolkit, and some of which I'll explore here today, working with some of these difficulties. And yet, sometimes we can hold an unseen belief that kind of, it's sometimes a belief that we think it's not possible to be mindful of certain difficulties. You know, for me, self-hatred was that way for a while. Very hard mind state to be present with. And, there can be beliefs that, well, this mind state, it's not possible to be mindful of this. And so we can sometimes jump quickly to other practices than trying to be with dullness or sleepiness, spaciness, mind states like that, spaciness. We inherently think, spaciness is the antithesis of mindfulness. How would it be possible to be mindful of spaciness? It is actually possible to be mindful of spaciness. This is the main bit of the biggest tool in my toolkit at this point is the confidence, the faith, the trust that mindfulness can meet anything. Anything. It is possible to be mindful, to have that awareness meet any experience at all. Now, it may not always be available to us, but that trust, that confidence in that possibility, in that essentially the capacity of mindfulness to meet experience, is a great refuge to have that kind of confidence. That is probably the biggest key for me at this point in my practice, is that confidence. And it has really led to a kind of an expanding, it's like, of where mindfulness can go in my practice. It's like, if there's anything that I feel like, wow, the mind just keeps slipping off of that, I get really curious about it. Like, how might it be possible for mindfulness to meet that? It's kind of a curiosity that impels the investigation. And then often I'll see the mind just slip off it again and again and again. But it's like, I know it's possible. I know it is possible for mindfulness to meet this. How might it be possible? And just keep exploring, keep trying. And so much has unfolded from that one exploration. How might it be possible to be mindful in this very situation? So I'm going to talk a little about two different areas of difficulty that we work with. One, physical experience, difficulty with the first kind of dukkha, pain in the body particularly, unpleasant bodily sensation. Typically, the main issue around unpleasant bodily sensation, and not something we might necessarily trust or understand initially, is that we don't like it. We resist it. That's actually the biggest part of the problem, that we don't like it, we want to get rid of it, we have aversion to the physical pain. So there's often, when physical pain is happening, at least two things going on. There's the pain itself, and there is a reaction to it, a mental reaction to it. And the largest part of the issue is the mental reaction. So this is in the terrain of what Kamala was pointing to this morning in the instructions around looking at our relationship, looking at our attitude to what is happening. So when there's pain in the body, noticing, what's my relationship to that? The aversion, the wanting it to go away, the wanting to control it, to fix it, to get rid of it, the feeling that it's a problem. So looking at our mental reactivity, we begin to be able to distinguish between the pain itself, which is physical manifestation in the body, unpleasant physical manifestation in the body, burning, stabbing, pulling, tension, tightness, aching, pressure, the kind of physical experience in the body. So there's that piece of it. And also very rapidly, dynamically changing experience in the body. When we actually start to look at what physical pain is, it is not static. It is not fixed. It's really, it's like sparking and moving and changing. So this is another area of exploration around physical pain, that often what we are reacting to isn't the actual experience of pain, because that's changing so rapidly. But it's an idea that has been overlaid on that, which is painful knee, painful shoulder. And we're reacting to that idea largely, and what it means. Painful knee. Am I going to be able to walk when I stand up? Or painful pain down the leg, you know, sciatica. This is going to be a problem. You know, we react to the idea actually more than the actual physical experience often. So it's really helpful to begin to see these various pieces that come together in the entire, our global experience of pain includes all of it. But to begin to distinguish the various threads that come together, the mental reactivity, the ideas, and the actual physical experience. So if you are experiencing reaction to pain, the aversion, the resistance, it's often not so helpful to try to be with the physical experience itself, because the reactivity is there. And when we have a reactivity to a physical pain, if we're trying to observe that pain, often we are observing through the filter or the attitude of reactivity. So essentially, if we're trying to observe pain when there's aversion in the mind around the pain, it's very hard not to observe that pain from the perspective of aversion. And so the suggestion is to step back and observe the aversion itself. The pain will be there, but rather than focusing on the pain itself, notice the aversion. What is it like to have aversion right now? There's a mind experience, and often I find too with aversion, the aversion manifests in the body as a bracing. You know, that there's the pain somewhere in the body, like in the knee, for example, and aversion is like the whole body tightening up. So the aversion is a mental experience that then leads to another physical experience of tightening. So if you can observe the aversion and how the aversion impacts the body, you might be able to step back a little bit from the aversion and just be with that. So observing pain is actually an opportunity to see a very dynamic interplay between mind and body. How mind impacts body, how body impacts mind. And in this exploration, it might happen, as Kamala pointed to this morning, if you are recognizing and observing the aversion itself, it might from time to time actually drop. In being with aversion, if you can be with aversion without further aversion, we will have relationships, attitude to our mind states as well. If we can be with the aversion and just, this is what it's like for aversion to be happening, we might see that aversion loosens up and maybe even drops at some point. This kind of seeing really begins to lead to the deepening understanding of what pain is. Because when that aversion falls away and there is just the physical unpleasantness. I remember on one of my first three-month courses, working with just this thing around a pain in my foot from where it was pressing into the floor sitting cross-legged. And at some point, the aversion completely fell away, and it was just strong, unpleasant sensation. And it was not anything like what I had called pain. It had very little relationship with what I meant by the word pain in my mind. It was just sensation, unpleasant sensation, but it was just sensation. No reactivity to that experience. That was a huge shift in my understanding about pain. So that's a kind of an opening of insight, of wisdom. And in seeing that as we see something like that, as we see a shift of perspective in direct experience, we get a taste of what is possible. I certainly, again, didn't sit there for the rest of the sitting without feeling aversion. It came back very quickly. But for a moment, I had had a taste of the possibility. The part of the thing we have to have compassion with ourselves about and open to is the fact that it takes many, many times of seeing this kind of insight before it really becomes more accessible to us. So, sometimes we see an insight like this and then we're back caught again. It's not something you're doing wrong when that happens. It's the habit of mind. Our minds have such strong habits about reactivity to things, particularly around pain. So in exploring pain, I just like to suggest, first of all, know in this exploration, first thing, if you have physical pain coming up, the first thing to tell yourself is, it's okay to move if it gets unbearable. I'm going to play with seeing if I can explore this physical pain, but it's okay to move if it gets unbearable. It's not helpful to grin and bear it, or to grit teeth and bear pain just for the sake of sitting still. It is not helpful, because that is cultivating basically a mind of tight, contracted aversion. So not so helpful to sit there just, I'm going to get through this. So let yourself know it's okay to move. It's okay to move if the pain gets unbearable. And then with that knowledge, sometimes the mind is willing to play for a few minutes, willing to sit there with that experience and, okay, I can move. Let's see if I can hang out with this for a little while. Check your relationship. Check your attitude. Is there aversion? Is there resistance? If there is, notice that. And sometimes as the thought came up around, just noticing the skunk in the room this morning, it's like, you don't have to figure out just exactly what that resistance is. You don't have to figure out, well, is it frustration, or is it anger, or is it hatred, or is it wanting to control? You don't have to do that. Often the resistance will just manifest as a kind of a sense of, oh, that's all you need to know. Oh, is happening. Okay, what's that like? Just be with that. You don't need to kind of dive in and figure it out. Just, what is that? What is that like? So notice if there's tightness, tension, feeling of contraction. You can explore relaxation around physical pain. See if that supports you. Keep checking your relationship. And if it gets too difficult, it's fine to move. Move mindfully. Moving I mean, it's again, it's not so helpful to have the notion of, okay, I need to move. Kind of like, let's get that part over with. That's the distraction. That's not what the meditation is about. Allow yourself to move, but know that you're moving while you're moving. I sometimes play the game of, okay, what's the very first part of the body that moves as I need to adjust my knee? You know, sometimes it's a surprising thing, you know, so just kind of watching what happens, and then kind of allowing your body to move and seeing how it moves. So, you know, if I need to move my left knee, the first thing I'm going to do is shift my weight like this, and maybe shift my hand, and then lift my knee, and shift back. And that can all be done in mindfulness. It doesn't have to be outside of the practice. Remember, mindfulness can go anywhere, anywhere. Allow everything to be part of the practice. Another large area of struggle for us is challenging mind states. Our mental, our challenging mind states often, particularly ones that are habitual, have a lot of, like my self-hatred, for example, you know, it felt huge. I remember at one point on a retreat, kind of, I could see how deeply embedded that pattern was going way back in my life. It's like it had so many tentacles to it. And there was a little bit of a sense of, oh, it's enormous. That pattern is enormous. I'm going to have to be fully enlightened for that one to go away. So there was that kind of belief, in a way, that it just was vast and it was just hopeless in a way. So I didn't give up, thank goodness, but what I began to see, or the thing that I began to recognize, is like, okay, this self-hatred, this pattern, and many of our difficult patterns feel like they're just entwined with so many different threads, you know, unworthiness, confusion, anger, hatred, hatred at others, hatred at ourselves, blame, judgment, so many different things all wrapped up into this tangle of mess. And rather than like trying to pull apart the tangle, figure out what all the threads are, you know, it's like, again, it's the skunk in the room. It's like, huh, what's obvious? What's obvious here? Just of this whole big mess, what's obvious right now? It might again be the feeling of, oh, a kind of a dropping feeling. Okay, that's what's obvious right now. What's that? What's that feel like? It might be a spinning in the mind. Oh, what's spinning like? So a curiosity around what our struggles are, what our difficulties are, but not a curiosity that is trying to pick apart, a curiosity that's willing to meet, that's willing to be with. I sometimes have the sense of like, okay, this thing is big, so let's just, you know, let me put my arms around the whole thing and see what is at the surface right now. We often, with things that are that complex, we think, and sometimes we may get intimations of what like the deeper layers of our difficult mind states are. So we may get senses that like, you know, gosh, it looks like fear is right in the middle of this whole thing. And we may get flavors of that from time to time in just meeting experience. Sometimes when we get those intimations, we want to dive into the middle and be with the thing that we think is right at the core, because we know, like, that's where it's at. I got to pull that piece apart, and then the rest of it will fall apart. What I've found in my own practice is that kind of diving in is not so helpful. It's actually jumping over what's actually happening right now, which may be frustration or confusion. So it's bringing an attitude of, I can fix this, to the investigation, rather than, what is this as the investigation? What is here? What is here right now? What is obvious? If you hang out with patterns and habits and struggles in this way, it's kind of like, you know, the complex nature of that big mess. The various pieces of it will kind of revolve around, and each time it comes up, there's going to be some different aspect of it, some different piece that is obvious. And so over time, we begin to get an understanding of the many different layers and threads. Each time we see one of these difficulties, we get a different perspective on it, learn something new about it. The learning about it is the point. The motion of diving in to find the middle to figure it out is engaging from that old perspective of, I need to get rid of this. The practice deepens and unfolds through willingness to be with and allow the understanding to unfold, to have the being with itself, you know, the meeting, the contact, the touching of our experience. It's like that very contact, the mind begins to understand what's going on at a level below our kind of conscious thought processes. And the mind begins to understand how the patterns are put together. I've seen this happen so many times, that this is another area that I really trust, that it's not the letting go, that abandoning, which is, you know, the comes from the willingness to be with. The mind lets go on its own when understanding happens, because essentially this organism is kind of would like to head towards well-being. The mind-body organism would like to head towards well-being, only there's so much confusion and misunderstanding and misperception that has us looking for well-being in the wrong places. The more the mind is just with experience, meeting experience moment after moment, the more the mind understands and sees through some of those confusions and misperceptions and misunderstandings. And it gets better information. The mind gets better information about where well-being can be found. It's not found in holding on to things. And the mind itself begins to understand how to let go of the things that are creating our struggles. So, Saito Utejaniya, one of my teachers, talks about our practice being like gathering data, as a naturalist gathers data. You know, a naturalist goes out into the woods and looks around and witnesses things, watches how plants grow, watches the cause and effect unfolding, gains knowledge through the willingness to observe over a long period of time. And this is our practice, this being a naturalist, being an explorer in our minds and bodies. We explore our experience, and the understanding begins to grow. So with difficulties of mind, what is obvious is the first kind of exploration, the first kind of way to meet it. It might also help at times, depending on how much reactivity there might be, there can be some other explorations that might be helpful. How does this mind difficulty, this struggle, impact the body? Anger feels like pressure and heat arising. Confusion may feel like bees buzzing in the head. Just a kind of an energetic sense. So sometimes it can be helpful to ground the experience when meeting experience, to ground it in the body. Partly because the body, the mind will typically go into thinking, and the reactivity of our difficult patterns are often cemented into place by our thought processes. The thinking about being angry at somebody, they shouldn't have done that, I got to figure this out, I got to tell them this, that, and the other thing, that keeps the anger going. And if we can drop into the body, it helps to move us away from the thoughts that are keeping re-triggering the feeling. So taking refuge in the mind's capacity to meet the experience in the body. Checking in from time to time, what's your relationship to this experience? Fear. What's your relationship? Fear is arising. Well, what's your relationship to fear? Confusion, perhaps. Maybe there's confusion. What is this about? Why am I afraid? So confusion is arising. What is the experience of confusion? So the checking the attitude is a great way to uncover hidden filters, hidden agendas, hidden perspectives that we're bringing to experience but are unaware of. So checking in from time to time when there's a difficulty. What's my relationship to this difficulty? There's always more to say than there's time to say it. So I think I'll just end by pointing to when we are suffering, when there is the experience of struggle, even just the subtlety of a feeling of off. This is, just this feeling of things aren't right. That feeling, that experience of suffering is a pointer. It is showing us that there is something that is not understood. It's not a mistake. It's not a problem. It's actually, if we're willing to be curious, investigate, what is it that's not understood here? The exploration of suffering is the path. It leads to the understanding, the abandoning, in a very organic way. Not something we do by getting rid of or fixing or constructing, but by understanding the letting go happens. Back to this simile of the cloth. That understanding the kalesa, understanding the defilements, the abandoning happens, the confidence arises, the concentration, the beautiful states of mind arise, love, awareness. It unfolds very naturally. Suffering is our beacon. It points us to what we have to know and understand. This is our shift of perspective around suffering. So let's just sit for a minute.